Beijing has targeted Tsai, has identified Tsai as someone who they perceive to be trying to undermine cross-strait relations.
Taiwan vows to stand firm against mainland pressure. It's Tuesday, August 21st. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're also found on Facebook at VOA Asia. Coming up, Indonesia suffers more earthquakes. Korean reunions are underway. Myanmar's disappearing rings of beauty. Digital addiction and uranium from the sea. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Taiwan President Tsai Ing-wen said Monday if the self-ruled island would not bow to pressure after her high-profile trip to Latin America, including stops in the United States, which drew criticism from China. While Tsai was not invited to the United States for an official visit, she met U.S. senators while she was there, attended banquets with overseas Taiwanese, and spoke of the need for strong ties with Washington. The number of countries that now officially recognize Taiwan has been whittled down to 18, following moves by Burkina Faso in West Africa and the Dominican Republic in the Caribbean region to formally switch relations to China from Taiwan this year. China, which claims Taiwan as its territory, has ramped up military and diplomatic pressure in an attempt to assert Chinese sovereignty over the island, even as the U.S. government makes fresh overtures to it. How much pressure are Taiwan, China, and the United States under? That's the question VOA Asia's Ira Melman asked of Matthew Funioli, a fellow in the China Power Project of the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Well, the pressure now is certainly more intense than it's been either with her first visit, with President Tsai's first visit, or with visits by previous presidents from Taiwan. And I think that a lot of that has to do with personality. I mean, Beijing has targeted Tsai, has identified Tsai as someone who they perceive to be trying to undermine cross-strait relations or upset the status quo. And so really anything that she was going to do on this visit had the potential to intensify cross-strait relations. I think the sort of interesting thing that you see now is that Beijing has started to try to target foreign companies with the sort of airline restrictions earlier, wanting airlines to sort of refer to Taiwan as a province of China. And now in the sort of a little bit of fallout from the from Tsai's visit, they're targeting the Taiwanese coffee company, 85 Degrees C, which she made a visit to and she had coffee at. And now as a response to it, there's been protests in Beijing against protests and boycott against going to the coffee shop. The products from both the coffee shop and the bakery have been removed from apps online in China. And there's been a huge sort of market share loss for 85 Degrees C. So things are certainly heating up, I guess you could say, as far as the sort of response that you see from the transits. And now there's definitely a sort of commercial angle to it as well.
In contrast to that type of criticism, the Pentagon came out a few days ago and said that China, at least as far as they are concerned, seems to be beefing up its military, making sure that its long-range bombers can reach the United States and Taiwan. And there have been other instances of China seemingly kind of bolstering its defenses, if not offenses, for the United States and Taiwan. Can you expand on that at all?
Yeah, I mean, there's really sort of two things to keep in mind here. I mean, one is that with any state, as it gets richer and more powerful, it's going to look to build up its military. So that's natural as far as international politics are concerned. Where the United States and where Taiwan, where Japan, and where other countries in the region have questions is the intentionality behind those growing capabilities. And there seems to be an increased fear among those countries that China may wish to use these new platforms and these new technologies to rebuff the existing rules-based international order. And we really see that happening in places like the South China Sea, where China has continued to militarize the artificial islands in the area. And it seems to be pushing back against what the U.S. and the rest of the countries in the region have really relied on, which is freedom of navigation and which is the sort of free exchange of ideas and free trade.
There was a headline in The Guardian a few months ago, in April, as a matter of fact, saying, will China turn Taiwan into the next Crimea? Now, do you see anything about, you know, China maybe ratcheting up so much that there is the possibility of military action against Taiwan?
Well, I mean, I think that in their strategic planning for Beijing, they're always sort of thinking about this contingency and thinking about having the capabilities for it. What I think that you're seeing on a number of different fronts is are always a response to that potential threat. I think the United States, with its strategic planning, takes this into account and attempts to counter any efforts that may be trying to ramp up towards that. And I think Taiwan is as well. There's been a shift in Taiwan's sort of defense thinking away from the sort of traditional stance that you would have seen in the 60s and the 70s, that Taiwan is at some point in time going to return to the mainland and retake it as its sort of political center. And it's really started to shift towards understanding that if there is any type of potential conflict with the mainland, that winning or losing it is going to happen in the littoral seas around Taiwan. So there's been a shift in a lot of different ways of how people are sort of thinking about this. But for Beijing, it really becomes a challenge for it. You know, using force against Taiwan comes with a huge political risk about how that would be perceived domestically. If Taiwan is, in fact, from their perspective, part of China, and they're using force to bring it back into the fold, then there's a political risk as well that could be seen as an illegitimate action. So certainly China's military capabilities are ramping up, and certainly part of their sort of contingency planning deals with Taiwan. But I don't necessarily think it's in their best game right now to sort of look in that direction and try to figure out how they would use military force to sort of bring Taiwan back into the fold.
Matthew Funioli of CSIS, the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He spoke with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find right now on voanews.com. At least 5 people killed in new earthquake in Indonesia's Lombok Island. Possible Chinese president visit to Pyongyang raises doubts on sanctions. Amid fiscal woes, Malaysia Prime Minister calls for China's understanding. Australian Prime Minister scraps plan to legalize carbon emissions cuts. Vietnam controls inflation, avoids broader economic fallout. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. The death toll continues to rise, with at least 10 fatalities reported following a series of earthquakes that jolted the Indonesian islands of Lombok and Sumbawa Sunday, including a powerful 6.9 magnitude trembler. These are the latest quakes to shake the region since late July, leaving hundreds dead, tens of thousands of homes damaged, and hundreds of thousands of people displaced. Phil Cummins is a senior seismologist at Australia Geosciences. He explains to VOA's Victor Beatty why there have been so much seismic activity in the region.
South of Lombok and Bali, the Australian plate is converging on what's called the Sunda plate. That's the one that Indonesia sits on. And the Australian plate dives beneath that in a process called subduction. But this creates stresses, especially since the Australian lighter material from the continent, the Australian continent, is now sort of jamming the subduction zone, and that doesn't want to dive beneath the cinder plate. So it's sort of jamming things, and the plates are pushing against each other. A lot of stress is building up, and we're getting these thrust earthquakes, what we call thrust earthquakes, on the northern side of Bali Lombok. So it's not on the southern side where the plate boundary is, but it's on the northern side because of this thrusting, and that's due to all these compressive stress that has been produced by this collision of the two plates.
Do we have any idea how long this process will last?
There's really no way of saying, you know, whether there will be other larger earthquakes or whether the activity will simply die off after this. It's very difficult to say. There will be aftershocks, which will decrease in frequency and intensity as time goes on. And hopefully that's what will happen now, but it's really hard to say whether there might be another one or not.
There was also a report of a major earthquake in excess of 8 magnitude near Tonga in the Pacific Ocean, but it was so deep it didn't really cause much impact. Is there any relation between what happened there and what's happening off Indonesia?
I really don't think so. I think that the distances are just too far. The other one is quite deep, as you say. So I think that they're just two different, very different locations, very different types of earthquakes. So I think it would be very difficult to draw a connection between the two.
And, of course, we had the big 2004 tsunami triggered by that 9.3 undersea earthquake. Is there any fear that something like that may also happen?
Well, these earthquakes north of Lombok and Bali, they can trigger tsunamis. They have in the historical past. So, yes, they could trigger tsunamis. I don't think that they won't get as big as the 2004 tsunami. On the other hand, on the southern coast, you know, there's always the possibility of getting a large subduction zone earthquake there, and that could be quite large and trigger a large tsunami. But I don't know that the chances of that occurring now are any greater or less than they have been in the past.
Many jittery residents on Lombok are without power and choose to sleep outdoors to avoid being trapped as aftershocks continue. The economic toll of the August 5th quakes is set at nearly $350 million. Happening now in Asia, heavy rains are drenching the Indian state of Kerala, and that slowed attempts to deploy rescuers to get relief supplies to isolated areas. Many have seen no help for days and can only be reached by boat or helicopter. More than 300,000 people have taken shelter in over 1,500 state-run relief camps. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're with us today on VOA Asia. Dozens of elderly Koreans gathered Sunday at the South Korean border with North Korea and have now made their way to the north to be reunited with family members there. Some of the meetings are the first since the 1950s when the Korean War separated them. VOA Slotika Hoke reports that many say they're lucky to have lived long enough to see their family members again.
Participants who had been selected for the reunions gathered Sunday at a resort in the border town of Sokcho. They attended an education session and had a basic health checkup before they could cross the border for a three-day trip to the north.
Most participants are elderly, and many of them are suffering from hypertension and diabetes and have underlying medical conditions. Ahead of the reunions, we are thoroughly checking their health conditions so that they can attend the events as planned.
More than 57,000 South Koreans have registered for a chance to meet relatives in North Korea. But only 93 were chosen for the latest round of brief reunions, which were to begin Monday in North Korea's Mount Kumgang tourist resort. 88 North Koreans were allowed to participate. South Korean Lee Soo Nam is meeting his older brother in North Korea.
I lost a brother, and my parents lost a child. But my brother lost his parents, siblings, friends, and an entire hometown. He probably spent his entire life longing for all that. It's heartbreaking just to think about it.
This 94-year-old grandmother will see her son's daughter for the first time.
I am happy. I do not get to see my son, but I am happy that I am meeting my granddaughter.
Families will have 6 face-to-face meetings with their North Korean relatives over a 3-day period. This latest reunion of Korean families comes after the relations between the two countries warmed ahead of the Winter Olympic Games in South Korea in February. On Saturday, representatives of the two countries met ahead of the opening of the Asian Games in Jakarta. Zlatica Hope, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up, an Asian fashion trend fades. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
The latest news from VOA Asia. Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has abandoned plans to enshrine the nation's targeted limits of greenhouse gas emissions into law in the face of an angry revolt by his party's staunch conservatives. Australia set a target to cut carbon emissions by 26% below 2005 by the year 2030. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, for hundreds of years, Kayan women in Myanmar have worn coiled bronze rings around their necks, a traditional and customary symbol of beauty. But now, as VOA's Julie Tabo tells us, a new generation of women from one of Asia's most distinctive ethnic minorities are choosing not to follow in the fashion footsteps of their long-necked ancestors.
48-year-old Mutu is a Kayan woman from the Kaya region of Myanmar. For generations, women here have worn bronze rings around their necks and other parts of their bodies. Mutu is one of the few women who knows how to make the heavy embellishments and put them on.
The shorter sets are easier to make. Everyone has their own preference. So if someone doesn't like what you've put on, you have to take it off and start over.
83-year-old Maria Ken has been wearing the coiled rings on her neck, wrists, and knees since childhood.
I started to wear the rings when I was 8. My dad told me I looked like a boy. He said, so I'll buy you a gun to hunt as a man. But I said, every girl is wearing the rings, so I want to wear the rings too.
Maria has never removed the rings, even when cooking, eating, or working.
It is comfortable. At first it was hard, but now it's fine. I eat and food goes down.
While wearing neck rings was once expected of all Kayan women, more and more have started to shun the practice. Among them is Maria's granddaughter, 20-year-old Zaza U.
They're heavy and uncomfortable. Also, I don't know much about them. That's why I don't wear them.
What is known is that besides extending their necks, the practice crushes collarbones and causes discomfort when swallowing. Even Mutu admits that safety is a concern.
If you don't make the rings correctly, someone can choke.
Whether safety or changing fashion, many young Kayan women are turning their backs on tradition, even as the old ways bring tourists and curiosity seekers.
When I bring the gap to here, I want to let them know the true story of the people in here. So these people is also my people. So why people are calling them as a like a human song, graphic woman, like a Badao. But our origin is Kayang.
Cultural analysts estimate that there are now fewer than 100 long-necked women across the whole of Myanmar, down from about 300 to 400 several decades ago. Some wonder if the tourists will still come to buy their wares when the long-necked women are gone. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
This news from VOA Asia, Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad is seeking to renegotiate billions of dollars worth of Beijing-funded projects. Before traveling to China last week, Mahathir suspended three major infrastructure projects that are funded with Chinese loans worth more than $20 billion. All the big stories are free for you on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, some medical experts are warning that technology addiction is a growing problem as people's daily lives increasingly revolve around their devices. Companies and governments are working to alleviate the problem. VOA's Jill Craig has more.
It may be difficult to imagine the days before digital devices consumed our lives. But some experts warn that constant attachment to our phones, tablets, computers, and other devices is negatively affecting our health.
At an ordinary level, for many people, particularly the impact of sleep debt, because they're not sleeping enough because of the light from screens, and overuse, particularly of social media and games, means that depression and anxiety are more likely.
Different studies place the number of those with tech addiction between 1% and 6%.
But as we're seeing a convergence of different rewards that you can get through the use of technology, and we're spending more of our time on screen working, playing, creating, fighting, whatever it is, we're actually living through the devices more and more, and then living without them is becoming a real issue.
Google has announced a digital well-being dashboard, and Apple is expected to launch a digital detox feature later this year. France has effectively banned after-work emails and soon will introduce laws to prevent students from using mobile phones on school grounds. Tanya Gooden, who ran a tech business for more than 20 years, says parents are giving their children devices at young ages.
You see what I call digital babysitting, where a parent gives a child a phone just to, you know, for a few minutes apiece. So yeah, it is starting earlier and earlier.
Gooden now runs a company that offers digital detox retreats, where people switch off their phones and instead participate in nature activities.
To be honest, the simplest thing to do is just put our phones out of sight, because all the software we have on our phone relies on us actually being able to see it, to see the buzzes, the banners, the notifications. Muting it is also a really good thing to do. But if it's out of sight, it really is out of mind.
For many of us, however, it is perhaps easier said than done. Jill Craig, VOA News, Washington.
The world's oceans are filled with trace amounts of uranium. That's the primary fuel for nuclear power reactors. The trick is extracting it from the seawater. Now, scientists in the United States say they've done that using yarn. VOA's Faith Lapidus reports the innovative process has yielded 5 grams of the powdered form of uranium used to produce reactor fuel.
With ordinary acrylic wool, the kind you knit into sweaters, researchers have developed a technology that could power the future.
After many more experiments, finally we found the optimum conditions. The acrylic yarn contains a chemical group which can be converted to specific chemical groups for extraction of uranium from seawater.
The ocean contains about 3 parts per billion of uranium. But that minute amount adds up to some 4 billion tons of potential fuel, enough to power nuclear reactors for the next few centuries. To determine the optimal conditions for extracting it, bundles of treated orange yarn were attached to the floor of a pool at the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory in Seattle. Mimicking the action of the waves, a paddle wheel circulated raw seawater over them for a month. The researchers tested the yarn regularly to see how much of the radioactive substance adhered to the surface of the fibers.
We're able to control seawater. We use natural seawater. We can control the temperature of that deployment. We control the current flow, which are very important parameters that we've identified in the performance of the absorbent.
The yarn was then sent to LCW Supercritical Technologies, where it was processed to extract the uranium powder. The initial sequence yielded 5 grams of yellow cake, the basic component of the fuel rods used in nuclear power reactors. Now, 5 grams is not a lot, but scaling up the process could be a game changer for the U.S. nuclear power industry, which currently imports nearly 90% of the uranium it uses. The technology has potential for other fields as well.
This material also can extract heavy metals, precious metals, so I can see many applications, including removing toxic metals from waterways, industrial wastewater treatment, and also recovering precious metals from streams.
And that's good news for the future of the oceans. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us online, on iTunes and SoundCloud, streaming on VOA Asia Facebook, and our website, voanews.com. We'd also like to hear from you. You can contact us on many of the online platforms. You can also send us one of those old-fashioned emails. voaasia@voanews.com is our address. We'd love to hear from you. A lot of you have heard us on the radio, DZUP, 1602 AM radio, at the University of the Philippines, Diliman, in Quezon City. We thank everyone there who's tuned in today. We thank our great staff who helps us bring this program to you, our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Zita Abdel-Rahman, Our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, including Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day.